This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Chapel Hill native Blair Tyndall played with some of the biggest names in classical music. She has performed the oboe on stage. She played the oboe on stage at Carnegie Hall. She's played in the orchestra pit for Broadway musicals like Les Miserables and Miss Saigon. She ended up playing the oboe, though, completely by accident. She's in sixth grade. She gets lined up alphabetically. Her teacher says, pick your instrument. She's a T, so all that's left is the oboe and the bassoon. Oboe is lighter, so she chose that. Well, more than four decades later, her musical career is the subject of a new Amazon Prime TV series called Mozart in the Jungle. The show's a spinoff of her 2005 memoir about her decades-long journey in classical music and all the drama and politics that takes place behind the scenes. Blair Tyndall's in town from Los Angeles. She joins me on the show right now. Welcome to State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me, Frank. It's exciting to see this new studio here in Durham.
Welcome home. You went to preschool or kindergarten just down the street, right?
I did, maybe a half mile away.
Wow.
The Tweddell School. I think it was torn down in 1966.
But raised in Chapel Hill.
Yes.
Tell us about that and a little bit about your family background. Your dad was a scholar at Carolina.
Yes, my dad was a professor of Southern history, specifically Black history of South Carolina. And he wrote one of the leading American history textbooks. So a lot of people who've gone to college and taken American history used his book in the last 30 years or so. My mom is also from South Carolina, and they were big proponents of the arts. And we came over to Raleigh all the time to hear the Friends of the College series, visiting orchestras and such. So I was very much steeped in the arts as I was growing up.
I mean, the North Carolina Symphony, one of the first publicly funded, if not the first publicly funded symphony orchestra in the country, and a statewide orchestra. So you have access to that. Tell us about but not necessarily a musical family, right?
Well, everybody played piano and sang just for fun, as people did before the 1960s. So I think we were all musical.
But the oboe story, am I right about that?
That's absolutely correct. I was so disappointed. I wanted to play the flute or the trumpet.
Oh, man. Yeah, the oboe. How long did it take you to like it, or do you now? You might not like the oboe. I don't know.
It's a challenging instrument. Yeah. You have to make your own reeds by hand, so that's very time-consuming. But there are very few good oboe players out there, so you end up getting a lot of plum assignments. So it's now that I have been playing it for a very long time, decades, it's really a lot of fun to play.
You went to the Durham School of the Arts back in its very early days, right?
North Carolina School of
North
the Arts.
I'm sorry, the North Carolina School of the Arts, yeah.
Yes. I went when it was 10 years old, and it was really a school like none other. It's part of the university system. I don't know if people realize that.
Yeah.
So there's a college, but the high school program is a part of the public high school system here in North Carolina.
Yeah, it's an amazing system, and again, it speaks to North Carolina's support for education and the arts and culture. That had always been the case. We hope that would continue in this state. But you were a beneficiary, although it was a very different place. Now, there's a strong emphasis on both the arts and academics. They've got all that in place. But I think early on, you said that it wasn't as strong academically.
It was pretty weak academically for, I think, high school and college. There were some really incredible arts professors there at the time, but they were just figuring it out because there was really no school like it outside of Interlochen, which is a high school in Michigan for the arts. But it has definitely changed dramatically. So many renowned performing artists have come out of the school. And now they have a big emphasis on a film program there. And
yeah.
I'm in Los Angeles, and I see the influx of people from the School of the Arts there. It's quite a school.
What did that mean for you, though, when you got out? You had some pretty good training in music and the oboe, but your SAT score is not so hot.
I don't remember what they were, but the verbal score was pretty high because that's just genetic. But the math score was not so good. And here's something that sums it up. I put this in the book. They bust us over to take the SAT test, and one of the ballerinas said, "Why is this called the SAT test? Because it's Saturday?" Nobody had prepared us at all.
Okay.
We had no idea what we were doing.
You were not ready. So that means that whatever you thought you were going to do with this musical training, it's now going to be music. You felt like there were not many pathways open to you.
I probably, if I'd really sat down and thought about it, I probably could have taken a year off and maybe taken some community college courses and prepared to see if I could go to Carolina or something. But anyway, I took off for this great adventure and went to New York all by myself when I was 18, and it has been a great adventure.
You went to the Manhattan School of Music.
I went to Manhattan School of Music.
Yeah, and so tell us about that, living in Allendale.
Yeah, so my book revolves around the building I lived in, which was kind of, I described it as the Ellis Island of classical music. Everybody who came to New York knew somebody who lived there, and you would get the lecture, you have to go into the office and give the rental agent some money under the table. So I came in with my parents, and we didn't really like the guy. He seemed a bit racist, and that didn't go over well with us. So we went away, came back, and then I was supposed to give him $300 under the table, so I kept looking for the opening under the table. Couldn't figure it out. Anyway, it worked, and I ended up living there for 21 years.
But quite a community. I mean, these are all musicians, or mostly all musicians, so you're really surrounded by people who are interested in the same thing.
Well, yes, and just from half a block away, the building almost makes sounds itself. Yeah. I mean, the music pouring out of this building was quite incredible.
Yeah, but so were the characters, and this is where we are introduced to sex, drugs, and classical music. This is a wild place, it turns out.
Well, I tried to make the building a character of its own in the book. I was kind of surprised. The book has been made into a TV show. I was kind of surprised they didn't use the building as a character, but the show is made by the Coppola family, so I think they know what they're doing.
Yeah. But tell us about that, and tell us about the people who made that building a character.
Well, I chose three people in the building. There was a very close friend of mine who was a glamorous, tall, blonde flutist who personified the future of the arts in America. I moved in 1978. She was a few years older than I was. She's still playing in one of the major Broadway shows. It's been going forever, so you can probably figure out which show that is. And she's had a pretty good career. There was an older woman who was the person that we dreaded becoming, who was kind of deteriorating and had been having an affair with an opera singer for 30 years. Finally, the man's wife died, and they got married and I think had about 2 years together, and so she's still living. And the other character, who hasn't shown up in the show yet but may, was Samuel Sanders, who was this phenomenal pianist who made accompanying soloists sort of a respectable profession. He, when he was born, was a blue baby, and he was expected to live for 8 years or 9 years. He did make it to 62. He had two heart transplants, and he was most notably Itzhak Perlman's accompanist. So he did tell me the story once of being met at the airport. And of course, they had a wheelchair for Itzhak because he's a polio victim and walks with crutches. And Sam was just, he was kind of a week before a heart transplant and just sliding down the wall, fainting, and nobody noticed. But he had a remarkable career. And whenever I feel like complaining, I think about Sam.
Now, as an 18-year-old girl living in Manhattan in this kind of interesting environment at the Allendale, you weren't thinking about writing a memoir. You were mostly just figuring out how you were going to make a living, right?
You got it. The memoir did not come until a good 20 years later.
So tell us about that. How did you get to, it's a great story about how you got your first Broadway gig.
Well, I had a friend whose mother was the oboist in Les Mis, and you need substitutes. So she talked to her mom, and I talked to her mom, and she used me. She didn't really know me. And I made sure that I was just on top of everything and available at a moment's notice. So that worked out well. And then the man who hired orchestras for tours, Broadway-type tours that, say, come through Raleigh, he hired me for a tour called The Music of Andrew Lloyd Webber in Concert, which was a great tour. And the music director for an upcoming show was the conductor on that. So he hired me for Aspects of Love, which was an Andrew Lloyd Webber show.
I was surprised to read in your memoir how little auditioning there seems to be. There's a lot of word of mouth and a lot of the sort of substituting for people who have already gotten the job, right?
For freelance orchestras in New York City, which is governed by the union Local 802, it's actually illegal to hold auditions for any freelance job. It's against the union bylaws, or it was at least in my time. For major orchestras like the North Carolina Symphony and New York Philharmonic, yes, there are national auditions. Right. They're advertised in the national union paper. But for these part-time gigs, no, there are no auditions.
And for long-running shows, I mean, maybe you can describe this for us, but the idea of you pretty much need to find a substitute explain the rules and what you would, what things would be like for you on a long run.
Well, once you start doing a show, it's over 400 shows a year, so you would probably have to check into the hospital in Butner if you kept doing that. Anyway, you're allowed to take off 50% of the time plus leaves of absence. You're, of course, not paid when you don't play, but you need somebody to cover for you. And it can be everything from substituting in the New York Philharmonic or the Metropolitan Opera to you just want to go home for a week or go on vacation. But you're allowed to, very liberal policy, but you have to really cover yourself well.
But that was great for you because there you are in the pit for Les Mis, right? And this is a big, a big step forward for you, a big break.
It was great. And we got very generous benefits. So I have a pension. I had health benefits. It was great. One of my favorite subs was the English horn player. So English horn is sort of a tenor oboe. And the New York City Ballet, she would be going absolutely out of her mind during Nutcracker season because it was just like playing a show. You'd have to play the darn thing, mm-hmm. even though it's much better music. And so we would just switch some nights because we just couldn't stand it anymore.
Well, what about playing 400 performances of Les Mis? I mean, that's got to get pretty hard on your ears.
Well, I mean, that's why they call it work.
Yeah.
It's a strange situation in the pit. I mean, it can get very loud down there, and there's stage fog pouring into the pit,
right.
Which has got apparently the same molecular structure as antifreeze.
You're
inhaling that. And a lot of people, I still have my gun mufflers from the show. You wear earplugs and gun mufflers when the helicopter's landing in Miss Saigon.
Yeah. But I'm also surprised to read, of all the surprises, and there's a lot of shocking, cool stuff in the book. The book, of course, Mozart in the Jungle, and Blair Tyndall is my guest, is the fact that you can actually read The New Yorker and had that on your music stand sometimes for those performances.
Well, I did a scientific study because I did play about 15 years on Broadway, and it seems that about 20% of people playing Broadway shows are comfortable enough to not use the music and to read something simultaneously. I had one friend whose specialty was maps. He was in a brass quintet that went on tour all the time, so he just constantly had an atlas on his stand. I don't really know what was going on there. That's Wayne Demain.
I can imagine, at a certain point, the music. I get that you don't have to have the music in front of you anymore, but I don't know that I could really be reading The New Yorker while that's going on. Could you actually focus on the magazine?
Well, I got through chemistry, economics, political science, and calculus at Columbia while playing the show. I had the calculator and textbook on my stand.
What surprised you most about the lifestyle of the Broadway musicians?
I guess people were just very casual, but very, very businesslike. I mean, it's freewheeling, but it's not freewheeling because you really do have to take care of business or you will be fired. Mm. And people just come, they do the show, they go home, they have families. It's not a wild party scene by any stretch of the imagination. But also just getting to know the actors and watching them. I think one of my most memorable shows was Les Mis. And I would watch these women in the women's changing area where, I mean, these theaters are from the 20s or before, and they're very, very small. They would be putting on their winch outfits and rubbing stage dirt all over themselves, and they were telling me they just could never wash it off. It was, it just was there for life.
Once a wench, always a wench, I guess.
I guess.
And when you even said that when you got that first gig, you're substituting, so it's not every night. You're a little paranoid about, am I on tonight? Is it tomorrow?
Well, I had substituted for a lot of things. I substituted in the New York Philharmonic for 10 years. So a couple of times the call would come at 7 in the morning for a rehearsal, or it would come at 10 minutes before 8 when somebody was stuck in the snow on the GW Bridge, and that was not Chris Christie's fault.
Long before that. And there are other freelance gigs. I mean, you talk about live performance, of course, in the Philharmonic or various symphonies and also in the pits on Broadway. But you got to perform on some soundtracks as well, right?
Yes, I did most of the Spike Lee films. and I think one is coming up here.
Yeah, we got a piece from the soundtrack from Malcolm X. Maybe you can tell us. This is actually, I think, a clip from the during the eulogy and the funeral.
It's the assassination. So when you see Malcolm X lying on the steps of the Audubon Ballroom dying, that's me. And this was the last thing ever recorded in RCA Studios. They turned it into an IRS office after I played this. What does that say?
I don't know. Let's listen. That is a clip of oboist Blair Tyndall playing on the soundtrack for Spike Lee's film Malcolm X. Blair Tyndall is with me today talking about that and her new, the memoir that inspired the Amazon Prime TV series Mozart in the Jungle. We played for Spike Lee. You also played with the Rolling Stones, right?
Well, I played with Charlie Watts, the drummer for the Rolling Stones. I played with a Rolling Stone. I did meet another one. I met Keith Richards. Very difficult to converse with that guy.
Yeah. Charming guy, though, seems to be.
He really did.
You know, in all of his interviews. What surprises me about that guy, just for a minute, is how much he seems to remember. Like details, like dates. You would think with the amount of chemicals that have flown through that man's mind, he could barely remember his name. Anyway, so what was that like? What was telling me about the Charlie Watts gig?
Well, it was at the Blue Note. And it was called Charlie Parker with Strings. It's an old thing from the 50s. It's for strings, harp, and oboe, and a jazz quintet. So I actually made very good friends with his bass player there, Dave Green. They were high school buddies, so I've kept up with him all these years. That was 30 years ago or so. But it was Charlie Watts is a real gentleman. I don't think he even drinks coffee. He's, you know, very dapper. Put together.
Somebody got to pay the bills for that band.
I guess so.
What, and the oboe, I mean, obviously it's an instrument very closely associated with classical music and that repertoire. Is it getting easier to find? Because especially in this area, in North Carolina particularly, you find bands that are really looking for interesting sounds and textures. The oboe can give you that. I'm surprised that more musicians and bands in popular music aren't sort of begging for oboists to.
Well, I'm not sure it's that versatile of an instrument. It's good for color here and there. And I have to say, with the advent of entrepreneurialism on the internet, it's a lot easier for people to get that sort of music going and to make these unique choices. But I think you wouldn't want too much of oboe on a single album.
No, but enough. It's color. It's texture. It can really kind of change the way, change the feel and the mood of the music if you're clever about that. And a big part of your career, and you even to a certain extent complained about this, that so much of the work, particularly of a freelancer, is just getting the work and getting paid, that you don't spend enough time, you thought, on the art itself.
Well, they do go into that with the TV show, which has been really kind of refreshing. They really understood what I was trying to say. Getting paid, if it's a union job, is really not an issue. But I think just finding the work can be very difficult. I really was in the New York halcyon days of freelancing. It's very difficult to find work now. And in fact, when I was on the set of the Mozart in the Jungle show a few months ago, the amateur orchestras are full of people like me who just can't find work now.
We'll talk more about that, your career and Mozart in the Jungle, the Amazon Prime TV series, with my guest Blair Tyndall as our conversation continues on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking today with Blair Tyndall. She's a Chapel Hill native whose career is the subject of a new Amazon Prime TV series, Mozart in the Jungle, named for her memoir. Mozart in the Jungle. You're doing all this music and the hard work of getting jobs as a freelancer, but then you took a turn in your career and you switched to become a journalist. Tell us how that happened.
Well, I had been trying to find another career path because I could tell I probably wasn't going to age well in this profession. And I ended up going to something called the Johnson O'Connor Human Engineering Laboratory, which sounds really frightening.
That sounds creepy. Yeah.
But what it was an old aptitude testing firm where they didn't ask you questions about yourself. They made you perform tasks that evaluated everything from memory for various things like design, numbers, and three-dimensional spatial visualization. So it seems I'd gone through life thinking I was good at the two things that I really was awful at. And so they recommended journalism. And I thought, who in the world does journalism? And I could sort of see things circling the drain with journalism, but I did it anyway.
The whole life. Had you ever thought you were good at journalism or writing? Was that ever interesting for you?
I had never written anything in my life, but I had a feeling it was genetic. My father wrote quite a few books. So anyway, I ended up writing a couple of things and submitting them to the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. So my first two clips were there, and I applied.
And right away in journalism class, I mean, that you started submitting things, and some people were telling you right away you need to write a book, right?
I wrote a very short version of the book in the first week of journalism school at Stanford. Mm-hmm. So I got into Stanford with a full scholarship at the age of 39, much to my surprise. Wow. And I wrote this piece. Everyone around the table was at least 13 years younger than I was, and they all were quiet after I read it aloud, and I thought, oh my God, what have I done? I gave up my job at Limes. And finally somebody said, you have to write a book. Nobody knows about this world. We all think you're a bunch of stuck-up penguins.
But you're not, it turned out. And usually the advice, you need to write a book, you just need to ignore that advice. You took it and wrote a good one this book took off, and people really wanted to know, except the people in your profession, your friends, pretty not too happy about what you did.
Well, it's been interesting. And I got together with a friend of mine who's an oboist in the New York Philharmonic, and she had read the book, and she said, you know, I just never could figure out why people were so upset about it. But as it turned out, very few people actually read it, and they thought it was some sort of salacious tell-all, which it's really about the rise of culture in late 20th century America, which would have sold about 3 copies if I hadn't added the memoir.
Yeah.
So I added the memoir, and I was trying to be very complimentary to almost everybody. Anyway, now people are reading it, and I'm getting a lot of emails from people saying, gosh, I didn't realize what the book was about. This is a great book. I'm making all my students read it.
Are you getting emails from musicians?
Yes.
Who are saying, now that I've read it, I see what it's all about.
Facebook is a wonderful thing.
And then it became an Amazon Prime TV show. Tell us how that happened. Because originally you were shooting for HBO on this, right?
Well, same show creator, yes. We did have an HBO deal. So the book came out, and there was a review. The very first review, I think, was in Entertainment Weekly, which, not being a Hollywood person at the time, I had no idea what it was. I thought it was like, you know, highlights for children in a doctor's office. Well, it's the big industry publication. And Jason Schwartzman, who's Francis Ford Coppola's nephew, saw it and optioned it from the get-go. So he had the rights for 10 years. We did get an HBO deal, which I can say now because he said it, and they passed on us for the show Girls, which is remarkably similar, female protagonist in New York doing naughty things. Then it went dead in the water for about 3 months, and he came roaring back with Amazon Studios. What is Amazon Studios? Yeah. But I think people are still unsure about this. In 5 years, I think any new TV in somebody's home will have this, just like a network that you can have like HBO. But Amazon Studios is like Netflix or Hulu with original programming. And one of their shows, Transparent, got 11 Emmy Awards, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you're launching a new platform, or if you're launching a new series on a different platform, then you're looking for content and you're hoping it's going to work. So they picked up the series, and we can take a listen to a clip from the very first episode of Mozart in the Jungle. Let's listen.
So you play just like unbelievably well.
Thanks.
North Carolina, right? Yeah, I'm from Nashville. That's kind of close, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of.
It's a pretty overwhelming place, huh?
Totally. I feel like all I spend my time doing is like figuring out how to make money, and then figuring out how to be a good roommate and good daughter, and like, none of it is about the art. So when I'm successful...
You think it'll be easier?
It better be.
There's a clip from the TV show Mozart in the Jungle, based on the life, career, and memoir of Blair Tyndall, North Carolina. So that's you on the front step of that, probably.
And strangely enough, the actress they chose, who's a wonderful young actress, looks, she's a dead ringer for me at the age she is now. She's 24. She looks exactly like I look.
Do you have much input on the TV series?
Oh, they'll call me occasionally and ask me a question. I think the funniest question was, if you drop your oboe on a stage, will it roll? So I didn't try it, but I know it won't.
Well, that's for the Foley people, because they're going to drop it, but then they got to put the sound effect in later, because all they had to do was do it. So they have to actually do that in post-production. That's why they asked you that. That's interesting. They would want to know that. And you probably didn't know either, because I bet you never dropped your oboe.
I did drop it once, but I did call my oboe repairman and ask him, and he said, absolutely not, it wouldn't.
Said,
what kind of question is that?
What about the series now? Have you heard from your friends in the community about the series itself?
Well, people were very skeptical at first because they thought it was going to be very cheesy, but the Coppola family is quite mired in classical music, and indeed, Jason and his cousin Roman Coppola are now co-creators. And their great uncle, Anton Coppola, is actually going to act in the series this year. He's 99 years old, wow. Famous conductor.
We talked about the fact that many of your friends were upset when this book came out. And because you did, I mean, there was the sex and the drugs in the classical music. And you talked a lot about the drinking games and the things that went on. And that moment, too, or a moment like it, is embodied in the series. In this particular clip, a bunch of musicians are playing a drinking game with their instruments.
This is a piano arrangement.
It doesn't matter.
Crap, Baroque. Never heard that before. Did this happen? Were you playing these games? Maybe you can describe exactly what the rules were for this one.
I am hoping somebody manufactures that game. It's a spin the bottle kind of drinking game where the bottle lands on, you know, Baroque or contemporary, and you have to take two or three shots and then play something incredibly difficult. That game doesn't exist. We never actually did that, but I wish we'd thought of it or we would have done it.
So how much of that actually is again, the creators of the program sort of moving it forward and adding inventions like that game?
Quite a bit.
Yeah.
The first season had a writer's room of 10 writers, and two of the writers, one was a very accomplished, well, she still is, very accomplished violinist. And the other was a sax player. So there were people who really knew music.
But the spirit of the thing is true. I mean, you talk about the partying that went on and a fair amount of... We're not just talking about smoking weed here. It's cocaine use and all that sort of thing.
Well, remember, this was the 80s.
It was the 80s.
So, I mean, all those people who were doing cocaine, and I was not one of them, by the way, Mom. They now don't even drink coffee. I mean, everybody's into yoga and such.
The only toot you did was on the oboe.
That's
is the subtitle of this book, in fact. I understand. But also, and you talk about the business, too, and I think that's something that you treat in the memoir, and it does get treated a bit in the series as well. This kind of disconnect, this problem that we all have when we're in good businesses, like, say, public radio or the classical music business, where the only way we can operate is in the nonprofit world. And that's a strange kind of business model for us all, isn't it?
Well, it is. And I wrote I've written quite a bit about that and the problems and the way it's evolved in the last 20 years. So I think one of the real eye-opening stories I wrote was for the New York Times about 10 years ago, regarding the salaries of performing arts executives and orchestra conductors. So at the time, and actually they really haven't risen much since then, possibly because of the story. Mm-hmm. At the time, I think the highest CEO salary of an orchestra, and there are CEOs of orchestras, somebody's got to run the shop, was almost $1 million. Somebody's making over $1 million now, but I have to say she's the best in the business and deserves it. Conductors are making over $2 million. They're there for 14 weeks sometimes and combine several of these music director positions. When people read that, they were absolutely shocked because nonprofits are non-taxable organizations that are supposed to return a public good. And I do think the IRS is going to take a close look if salaries keep increasing and wonder why they're not collecting taxes. So I think something's got to give there.
But you also talk about the fact that the changing business model, and some of those conflicts are evident in the series as well. Some of the things that folks might sort of look at cynically as just marketing tools, but really it's a way of opening up the music to more people, clever ideas about ways to get the music out there. And in fact, you had an experience like that, a kind of meta experience at the Hollywood Bowl just recently, right?
All right. This was one of the great nights of my life. I was in the royal box at the Hollywood Bowl with Roman Coppola. I never thought I'd say a sentence like that. Mm-hmm. And they had managed, I had put the production people together with the CEO, somebody I really respect a lot, of the LA Philharmonic. And their summer season is there at the Hollywood Bowl. Now, when I lived here, I had absolutely no idea what this place was. It's a huge outdoor amphitheater that seats 18,000 people. And they managed to get the fake conductor on stage.
From your series.
From my series, right. Gael Garcia Bernales, wonderful actor. And he conducted the LA, he actually conducted the LA Phil and just hammed it up like Leonard Bernstein, sort of swooping and making faces and grimacing. And it was so convincing and so funny. All of the musicians on stage were just dying laughing. They could hardly play. And the crowd loved it.
And his character is based largely on the conductor of the LA Phil, right?
Yes, Gael's character Rodrigo is based on Gustavo Dudamel, the Venezuelan character, and they're both Latin American, and they just hit it right off. And Dudamel was a good sport. I can't say what his role is in the episode, but people are going to die laughing. It's very funny.
And the orchestra was okay with it? They all hit their notes on time, even though?
I think they were kind of following the concertmaster, the mm-hmm. first violinist, but they seemed to be having a great time.
So I got to ask you about this. You were married for about 8 minutes to Bill Nye, the science guy.
Well, apparently we were not actually legally married.
Was that the drama yeah. continues. That was quite a story, Blair.
Yeah, the drama continues. He sued me and won, and so I owe him a whole pile of money.
I mean, look, I have to say it. This was in all the papers. He's accusing you of attempting to kill him and to sort of murder his garden.
I did murder his garden. It was our garden.
Okay, so that was community property. You can kill it.
He wasn't even home at the time.
Yeah.
So it's just one of those celebrity.
I have to ask you now, how did you come to, because it was a very short time that you spent together.
He read the book.
Yeah.
And decided based on the book he was going to marry me. And then when it became real, he decided maybe it wasn't such a good idea.
Okay, maybe he decides to marry you. That's one of those wacky things that happens out there in the world. I read a book and I'm smitten. But now a guy comes to you and says, I read your book, I want to marry you. You've got some choices.
Well, I was of an age where it seemed like a good idea at the time, you know, perhaps to have a family. You know, I have a lot of respect for him.
Yeah.
And you know, when you step back and look at it, you've got to look at everything with a lot of humor. Of course, I would never try to harm anybody, but it really is a pretty funny story when you read about it.
It's wacky stuff, and it gets wackier still. So what's next for you, Blair?
Well, I was just in Charleston, South Carolina, researching a screenplay that I actually wrote 8 years ago about a Black Civil War hero. And a lot of the story takes place in the Black churches of Charleston and the Lowcountry, which now is a good time to sell that.
Right.
And then there's a second memoir coming with lots of comical tales. I seem to get myself in all sorts of positions.
On that first story you talked about, I mean, it is interesting that you're now tackling the material that was your father's life's work.
I promised him I would write that story before he died. I mean, I promised him before he died.
He's going to do it. So you're liking this whole writing business. What about the music career? Where's that now?
Well, I was kind of persona non grata for about a decade, and now people are hiring me again. So I'm very excited about that.
Blair Tindall is my guest. She's a musician. She's a writer. Her life and career are the subject of the new Amazon Prime TV series, Mozart in the Jungle. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a thrill.
You can find out more about Blair's life and work. You can see clips from Mozart in the Jungle at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Widarski is sitting in today. Andrew Tai is our intern. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. Coming up tomorrow on The State of Things, we're going to take a look at a proposal by the state Senate. The state Senate passed a constitutional amendment that would lower the cap on spending and income taxes. House not so thrilled. There are warnings that North Carolina's AAA bond rating could be threatened. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about another continuing resolution, a temporary budget. We are two months, into the fiscal year without a budget. We'll find out what is holding up progress on that on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.